Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Tampa, Florida for an update on what was to be the first day of the Republican convention before Hurricane Isaac forced a postponement. Tina Dupuy, who is a nationally syndicated columnist and previous managing editor of Crooks and Liars, who is now editor-in-chief of TheContributor.com, joins us to discuss today's non-events at the Tampa Bay Times Forum. Then we will speak with Congressman Tom Piorello about the organization of money versus the organization of people in the $6 billion election underway that is awash with money, most of which is funding the Romney campaign with limitless and largely anonymous donors. Meanwhile, President Obama, who is apparently not comfortable groveling for money, lags behind due to a reluctance to engage in what is called donor maintenance, otherwise known as stroking fat cats. Then finally, we will speak with Jeff Connaughton, the author of a new book, The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. He was recently the chief of staff for Senator Ted Kaufman, and together they took on the Wall Street lobby, which is chronicled in the book as they try to bring the mega bankers to justice for the massive fraud that led to the crash of 2008, all the while fighting the institutional inertia of the Justice Department and the SEC, as well as the banking industry's determination to gut any reform of Wall Street. Joining us now is Tina Dupuy, who is an award-winning writer and investigative journalist, the former managing editor of Crooks and Liars, and the current editor-in-chief of TheContributor.com. Tina appears frequently on MSNBC, Current TV, RT, and the BBC. She writes for Mother Jones, The Atlantic, Skeptic, Fast Company, Alternate, LA Weekly, Los Angeles Times, and Newsdays, among many others. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tina Dupuy.
Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And you're in Tampa, Florida. You're there at the Tampa Bay Times Forum. At least that's where the non-event took place today. There was a brief gaveling, and about a second later, they closed the event. Now, I understand the Tampa Bay Tribune owes you some money back in 2009.
Oh, gosh.
And you created a YouTube video to shame the paper into paying the $75 they owed you. Now, what's the relationship between the Tampa Bay Tribune and the hosts of the Republican convention, the Tampa Bay Times Forum? Maybe you should have written an article for them, you know.
I know. I think you just outed me. I was hoping to just get into town and have them not notice. But thanks for blowing my cover there, Ian. It's really interesting down here, and I think this is actually a nice metaphor for where we're spending our money. The apparently all the security was not told that there's not going to be a Republican National Convention today because there are police checkpoints everywhere. There's far more, at least to me from my perspective, far more security than there was for the inauguration 4 years ago for Barack Obama. It's just thick with cops. And what, of course, is threatening the RNC is, strangely, weather and not this existential threat that we're trying to combat with police officers and guns. So it's a rather interesting story from that perspective.
Well, apparently the area where the Tampa Bay Times Forum building is, where the convention is taking place, is actually below sea level. So it looks like they've dodged that bullet, though, don't they? I mean, are there storm clouds looming as you speak?
Well, yes. Well, the last I heard is the storm is actually headed towards New Orleans. It might be a Category 1 hurricane, Category 2, which, of course, brings up the specter of Hurricane Katrina and the lack of response from the Bush administration, who, of course, is not being talked about at all. He's not being invited to speak at this Republican convention. So the optics of it are going to be very complicated for a Republican Party who's trying to seem more compassionate, different, separate than George Bush.
So, Tina Dupuy, the Republican National Convention today was supposed to have a briefing on the impact of Obama's economy on women with Courtney Johnson, the director of Women's Outreach, for Romney for president. Jovita Carranza, former deputy administrator of the Small Business Administration. Karen Agnes, founder of the Network of Enlightened Women. And Cheryl Harley-Lebon, advisor for women to Romney for president, was supposedly to moderate. Now, do you know any of these women, particularly the founder of the Network of Enlightened Women? I'd be interested in knowing more about them, because my understanding, at least in Democratic circles, there's this notion of a war on women. So I'm wondering why they canceled this women's forum today.
Well, I know that there has been there's a tradition in this country of right-wing women's organizations, and it's been around for about 100 years, and it's mainly bankers' wives, women who have the luxury of volunteering for right-wing causes in their church groups, and have opposed feminism and women's rights for the last 100 years. So for the Republicans to kind of have this kind of outreach thing is not a shock to me, but the war on women keeps on snowballing, and of course the Todd Akin claiming that women could not get pregnant if they were raped because a doctor told him so is not doing well for women to be treated like public incubators and also most women enjoy having birth control. Nearly 98% say that they enjoy having birth control. Part of the of what they're calling Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, was that birth control would be covered under your insurance. Now, ever since Viagra has been came out, that was covered easily by insurance, but birth control pills were not, and it's very expensive for someone who's, say, and Sandra Fluke brought this up to Congress, someone who is in college who's trying to make ends meet to do whatever in order to afford birth control pills, it's rather expensive. And so this is absolutely something that that women have been fighting for the last, 10 years specifically. And Republicans have not only come out against that, but they've also, again, their platform is to make abortion criminalized in all instances, regardless of the circumstances, which is a very extreme position. And it makes women, it basically makes a woman no longer a citizen with privacy rights. It makes that woman into a public incubator where what happens in her body is not her own choice. And most women do not like that whole concept, and the Republicans are kind of losing ground on, and the polling is showing that.
So you're telling me that you wouldn't want Congressman Akin as your gynecologist? Is that
or his doctor friend?
He's doctor, right?
I think that a lot of women do not identify themselves as a feminist anymore, that, we're in the second or third wave of feminism now, and a lot of women have just kind of figured that we are, we've come to a certain point where there's enough equality, where there doesn't need to be any kind of activist called feminist any longer, but the Republicans have done a fantastic job with slut-shaming, et cetera, to kind of get these younger women to identify with the feminist movement.
So, Tina Dupuy, again, an award-winning writer, investigative journalist, a former managing editor of Crooks and Liars, and now the current editor-in-chief of TheContributor.com. She's in Tampa. And tell me, though, my understanding is that there's nowhere now to get a decent meal in that town because the lobbyists have bought up all the restaurants. Is that true?
I had a pretty decent meal. I met some Italian joints, and it was not too bad.
Uh-huh. So
yeah, I don't know about that. Tampa's a very nice. It's a very nice town, and I had a fantastic meal. And I'm right next to Brooks Brothers, and I don't see any Republicans. So.
So it's not awash with the junior league women belonging to the Network of Enlightened Women.
Right.
Because my understanding is that this is all really all about the corporate lobbyists paying for everything for all of those people that they want to influence. And the biggest fracker in the country is Chesapeake Energy, and apparently they're supplying fleets of SUVs powered by Chesapeake fracked natural gas. Have you seen any of them tooling about?
I have not, but that does not mean that they're there. It's just my vantage point. I was at a Tea Party rally last night, speaking of fracking, or fracturing, as it were. I went to the Unity rally hosted by Michelle Bachmann, with the headliner being Herman Cain. Really fascinating. You had Herman Cain kept on saying that we did build this, President Obama, and then we get a standing ovation from a crowd that was mainly on Medicare. 80% by my estimation. And tonight we're probably going to end up at Christine O'Donnell's former senatorial candidate from Delaware. Christine O'Donnell is throwing an event for young Tea Party members. I guess there is such a thing. There's 71 people who have liked this on Facebook so far. But she's calling it the Troublemaker Fest. And we're going to head over there and see if there's any troubles to be making.
What is it some seance or a witch's coven? I mean, what's going to go on there?
I really, really hope so.
I see. So
I'll be very disappointed if it isn't.
And so just in the last minute or so, then is there what's going on with protests? Is there if you can't see any Republicans at the Republican convention, maybe they'll show up tomorrow, or maybe they're partying in private. But are there any protesters on the streets?
Yes, there's definitely protesters. There was one today. There was an Occupy protest of about, I believe, 500 people. Today was a really rainy day. It would go from being sunny to a downpour about every other hour or so. So there was a protest of, I was told from people who were there, 300 to 500 people. But, you know, again, it's very difficult to navigate anything because of the police presence. Yesterday, just to get into a bar near the convention, it took us a half an hour and our car was swept by Secret Service, and there was no convention happening. Everyone who is being protected by the Secret Service was not at the convention hall or anywhere near the convention hall, and yet it's very difficult to protest under these circumstances. So,
well, Tina Dupuy, I thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Ian, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Tina Dupuy, who is an award-winning writer and investigative journalist and a former managing editor of Crooks and Liars and the current editor-in-chief of TheContributor.com. Tina appears frequently on MSNBC, Current TV, RT, and the BBC. She writes for Mother Jones, The Atlantic, Skeptic, Fast Company, Alternet, LA Weekly, The Los Angeles Times, and Newsdays, among many others. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking with Congressman Tom Piorello about the organization of money versus the organization of people. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tom Perriello, who is the President and CEO of the Center for American Progress's Action Fund and Counselor for Policy to the Center for American Progress. Previously, he served in the United States House of Representatives, representing Central and Southern Virginia. Before entering politics, he worked as a conflict analyst and as an advocate on environmental and poverty issues. In 2010, Time magazine named him as a part of the 40 Under 40 series, citing his record as an unapologetic progressive. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Perriello.
Thank you for having me.
And you're quoted in the New Yorker's article by Jane Mayer, Schmooze or Lose, suggesting that President Obama has a choice. Either he schmoozes rich donors or he loses this election. And I just learned that this election is going to cost about $6 billion, which is more than the GDP of a lot of countries in the third world. What's your sense as we close in on November of whether at the end of the day it's all going to be about money or is it going to be about candidates and issues?
Well, unfortunately, the money is going to be incredibly influential. And even though people say they hate the negative ads and aren't affected by them, poll after poll shows that they are. And this is not an even race. Mitt Romney, I think, will have at least 2-1, maybe 3-1 in terms of billions. And we've seen a real shift in the kind of giving that goes on. It used to be that you would have rich conservatives giving to conservatives and rich liberals giving to liberals. But really now it's more like a return on investment system where you have corporations and individuals who have a direct stake in the game who want a return on investment. For example, the single biggest personal donor to Mitt Romney stands to make several billion dollars off of specific tax proposals that Mitt Romney has committed to. And that kind of return on investment does not have an equivalent on the progressive side. So I think the right response has to be, one, people-powered politics to overcome sort of the corporate capture on the other side. And second is to try to fix this system so it goes back to being a democracy that represents all Americans and not just the biggest checks.
So in terms of the people power that will level the playing field against this tide of big money, is there any evidence that, I mean, we wouldn't even be having a conversation, by my understanding, Tom Perriello, if Obama got the same votes he got in 2008, in 2012, right? I mean, the real issue is getting those people that voted in 2008 to vote in 2012. And you can see on the Republican side how Romney keeps throwing red meat to his base with the Bertha quip the other day, etc. So they're all fired up. Do you see a similar enthusiasm on the Democratic side?
Most of the polls actually show there's an enthusiasm gap that's more for the president than for Romney, where conservatives really have not felt like they can trust Mitt Romney or that he gets them. The Ryan nominations probably helped him with his base, and he's certainly been unscrupulous with things like the welfare ad that join a long tradition of Republicans' race politics and loose relationship with the truth. But I think, you know, leaving all of that aside, I think what you see right now is a very difficult economic environment, and I think certainly people feel like the heavens did not open when President Obama was elected. But I think voters are a lot smarter than pundits think they are, and they're going to ask the question, who's got a better plan for moving forward? And when they look at the plans, particularly the Romney-Ryan plans, they really don't like them. Voters over and over again have rejected these ideas, like voucherizing Medicare and ending it as we know it, or subsidizing outsourcing instead of American manufacturing, or doubling oil, you know, subsidies for the big oil companies that happen to be bankrolling your campaign. And, you know, I think voters are smart. I think they're going to look at that, and they see in Mitt Romney someone who doesn't get their economic experience and isn't looking out for them. And campaigns are about, you know, who's got a better plan and who's got a better communication strategy. You do see two factors with money. One is simply the fact that Romney has a lot more money, and he's got people writing literally nine-figure checks, which is just phenomenal and unheard of. But in addition to that, it's how they're spending their money. So with the more limited money the president has, he's put a lot more into direct voter outreach and voter organizing. And this will be a test in part of that strategy. Is it still all about who can buy the most 30-second spots? or is there a more sophisticated and technology-driven strategy of how to identify, voters, the voters that are already with them, the voters who might convert? I've been inside the machine, but I know it's considered the most sophisticated ever built. Is that kind of high-tech but people-powered politics going to be able to overcome, the money gap and the ad gap? It's going to be a very, very tight race down to the end. I happen to be out in Virginia today, which is the state that I'm from, meeting with small business owners and workers and educators and others about the economy. There's a huge amount of concern now over Medicare, given Ryan's presence on the budget, a deep concern about, for folks who are on the higher end of the income scale, Social Security and Medicare might be more of like a bonus for their retirement or a safety net. But for a lot of Americans, it's what they're going to retire on. And so it's a very different approach you take to sort of treating it like a voucher or a coupon if it's just sort of an also-ran factor, as Ryan treats it. For me, and there's generation statistics that our organization, Center American Progress, has put out, over my retirement, over the period of my retirement, the Ryan plan will cost me $240,000 extra. Now, I'm a former member of Congress who's still paying student loans. I'm a pretty young guy for a former member of Congress. Housing values, and so most of my savings aren't what they might have been in a different economy. And you're telling me that you're about to hand me a $240,000 bill of medical expenses for my retirement that I currently am entitled to have without paying that. These things are deeply concerning. So I think you're going to see the Medicare conversation play out. With the money conversation, it's interesting. People are across the board negative about the impact of money in politics. Even the vast majority of conservatives think corporations and money have too much influence. The question is whether people see any difference between the two sides and whether they see any potential to fix it. And I think as those of us that are not working, I'm right now working for a nonpartisan group, I want to figure out a system that we can do better, that can kind of revive and reinvent democracy and the democratic process for the 21st century in the context of this role of money. And technology may be part of that, but it's also going to be a matter of people stepping up and demanding better from their political leaders on both sides.
So, Tom Perriello, what does the president do, though, to the extent that he's facing? I mean, we have a situation that's so bizarre in this country where 5 million Democratic voters who have eligible to vote and voted before are being denied the vote and have to jump through hoops to prove they are who they are. Meanwhile, a handful of Republican billionaires are buying the elections for the Republicans and they don't have to prove who they are. And you've also got the Romney campaign since day one with its first ad in Iowa, where it put John McCain's words in President Obama's mouth. They're operating on a kind of ruthless cynicism and a kind of intellectual thuggery where rather than to debate the facts, they just invent the facts. Half the Republican Party believe that the president is a Muslim terrorist-loving interloper without a birth certificate. And you've got this extraordinary lying that's going on with the commercials that are out there now, that he wants to basically let people on welfare be freeloaders and take hard-earned money from angry white working-class guys who they're appealing to. And, of course, they threw them the bone about the Bertha comment the other day. It seems to me that this is a really difficult task, and I'm wondering what it's going to take to call them on the fact that they don't debate the facts, they invent them. They've invented this character that they're running against, Barack Obama, but he's nothing like the real guy.
Well, you just summed that up pretty well, and if I were to try to give an optimistic perspective, the first thing I would say is, despite all of that, President Obama's still winning in the polls, or even in the polls, even to up and most of them that are out there, despite the fact that the other side has been willing to lie, cheat, and steal in terms of the electorate. And so I think part of what we look at with that is, that it's incredibly depressing that people might be able to get away with this. We also look at the fact that many Americans are outraged. There's a reason that the president has more enthusiasm right now than Romney, which is that good-thinking people understand the kind of politics these guys are playing, the sort of billionaire capture, use any technique, no matter how immoral, appealing, whether it's on race lines or just making things up. I mean, part of what's astounding about the welfare ad is not just, you know, the crass Machiavellian politics of it, but the fact that it is so blatantly untrue that everybody has rejected it as being untrue, and they still came out with a second version of it. So to think about sitting around, normally you'd say, okay, you know, what's a fact that hurts the other side? How do we best package it? This is to say, how do we find an excuse to play this kind of deeply tinged and divisive politics and create a fact to make it work? So those things are incredibly depressing, and the sheer amount of money can be overwhelming. And yet you look at it and say, despite that, the fact is they have a product that in many ways can't be sold. You know, Mitt Romney is a very weak candidate. And what he may or may not have kept wanting to do was pivot to the middle. But the fact is the Republican base doesn't trust him. Independents don't trust him, and progressives don't trust him. And they're all right, in a way. I mean, clearly the platform has been pulled far to the right. You look at something like the Todd Akin comments about rape, and, you know, some are quick to say, oh, well, this is clearly one guy and came out of nowhere. And then you realize he and Paul Ryan co-sponsored the same bill redefining rape. This did not come out of nowhere. There is an actual systematic thinking behind this, which is also why, you know, Ryan and others have been unwilling to support the rape and incest exemption. But the thinking behind this comes from the same place of wanting to go back and end Medicare as we know it and think that tax cuts for the richest Americans are at the high end. I'm in the town right now that's that depends a lot on defense spending and has tended to be very conservative. But the conservatives here are saying, why do the Republicans repeatedly put protecting millionaires ahead of protecting military spending? Why in the budget deals did they were they more concerned with protecting millionaire tax rates than middle-class tax rates? These are actual priorities the Republicans have had a chance to do. Paul Ryan was part of the super committee. That was supposed to be the adults in the room. And not only did he fail to reach a compromise, by all reports, he was the main barrier to reaching an agreement that would have put us on a path to fiscal sanity. When John Boehner brought the deal back with the president, where the Republicans got 90% of what they wanted, the Tea Partiers looked to Paul Ryan, who is their intellectual or faux intellectual, you choose your work, leader, and said, how do you feel about this? And he said, it's 100% or nothing, and they wouldn't do a deal that risked the credit of the country. So these are facts that really upset independents, particularly independent women, and I think that's why ultimately we're going to see this election go in a progressive direction. And when I think about it, I'm not just thinking in terms of who wins. I mean, I am a supporter of the president, and I do hope that he wins the election. But more significantly, I think we could actually see this frame the economic agenda back towards how do we create a fair economy? How do we create a system that, that builds social mobility so that if you work hard and play by the rules, you can make it in this country? So I think that while the downside risk is very scary, it's also true that the upside risk is more than just another 4 years. It's about redefining the terms of the debate back to concepts of economic fairness and economic security, of an economy that works for all of us and not just the few, of a democracy that represents all of us and not just the few, versus a system that's very clear from Romney and Ryan. They want you to pay more so that they can pay less. The middle class pays $2,000 more a year in taxes. Mitt Romney gives himself a $4.5 million tax cut. You're going to pay $800 more for contraception and $1,100 or $1,200 more on the hidden cost of the uninsured for $4 billion in tax breaks to oil companies. These are priorities. These are facts. You know, and it used to be we'd hear from conservatives that liberals were too moral relativists, right? It was all sort of political correctness. Well, now, you know, it's them who say, well, there's no such thing as a fact anymore. It's just kind of what you feel about it. But without going into Stephen Colbert territory, there are facts here, and they do matter. And I think that's where we can think about not just an electoral victory, but creating a base for what I would consider, you know, a more progressive agenda at a time where working middle class folks are struggling.
Well, you just mentioned Tom Perriello, the Simpson-Bowles Commission on the deficit that Ryan essentially walked away from and scuttled what could have been a deal. And now, of course, that he and Romney are running against the very deficit that Ryan in particular did not even want to deal with. And that gets to the real question, which it seems to be the subtext here and the 900-pound gorilla, and that is it seems to be it's fairly obvious that the Republicans are, if not ruining the economy, they're sure as hell not helping its recovery. And I just don't see that they're getting called on it. I mean, is that what's the problem? Is there not enough proof? I mean, it seems obvious that they are trying to be both the arsonist and the fire brigade here.
Well, first of all, a quick clarification. Paul Ryan was part of the super committee that came out of the budget deal, the Simpson-Bowles committee has a different commission, but also one that was scuttled by Republicans. In fact, six Republican senators wrote the legislation to create Simpson-Bowles, and then when the president supported it, they had to vote against it. So they voted against the bill they wrote so that it would not be legislatively binding, and therefore they got off the hook for never having to vote on it, and it died. So that's, again, your point about saying, oh, we're the ones for this bill, if you don't, you know, for fiscal responsibility, we're going to write this bill, and then they got their bluff called, and the president said, let's do it, and they said, no, we didn't mean it. And that's the sort of thing, I mean, you would think that alone would mean these people could never show their face in public again to have done something so brazen and crass, but of course they just roll off to the next fight. In terms of the question about where they are in the economy, I do think they're paying a huge political cost for it. If you think about a year and a half ago, they came in on huge Republican wave in 2010, not just in Congress, but also many governorships and state houses across the country. And they came in on a message saying, these guys have sent the economy into the tank, never mind that we helped to sabotage that. And I think voters were willing to give them a chance. And what they found was this was a group that was much more interested in wreaking havoc and putting a far-right social agenda out there, putting forward the bill to redefine rape instead of a jobs bill, voting over and over again to repeal health care that they knew wouldn't go anywhere rather than actually solving the problem, putting the full faith and credit of the United States in limbo rather than reaching a debt deal, not being willing to accept 90% of what they're being asked for as a form of compromise. And I think that's why you've gone from the Republicans having a wave in 2010 to being less popular than I think any political party in modern history, representing a Congress that's only approved of by like 9% of the people. And as I recently said in a speech introducing the vice president, you know, it's Paul Ryan's Congress that over 80% of Americans think is doing a terrible job. It's Paul Ryan's Congress that chose to deal with the redefining rape instead of jobs. It's Paul Ryan's Congress that wants to cut benefits to veterans and to seniors by 17%. It's Paul Ryan's Congress that defeated three attempts to reduce the deficit. And it's Paul Ryan's Congress that voted itself for a five-week vacation instead of passing a jobs bill that's been sitting on their desk for over a year. And I think Mitt Romney is the only man in America who looked at this Congress and said, I want to hire the brains behind that operation. This is the kind of thinking that's going on, and I do think they're paying a price, which is why they're so incredibly unpopular. They just have a lot of money.
Well, I hope that we haven't become so cynical that old adage, nice guys finish last, is the rule of the day, that somehow facts can count and that enough Americans discover the better angels of their nature. And I'm looking for somebody to take their gloves off a little, but that's just my opinion, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're out in my day job with Center for American Progress Action. We're doing events, we're taking them to states across the country, and I'm finding people are really hungry for the facts, and they don't think there's anything nice at all about lying to seniors or trying to cut their benefits. And there is something kind about letting people know the truth, even though it's an unpleasant truth. So I think we're not doing anyone any favors by not getting out there saying the facts. I think it's what Americans want, and I think Americans will make a smart decision at the polls because of it.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Tom Perriello.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Tom Perriello, who is the president and CEO of the Center for American Progress's Action Fund and counselor for policy to the Center for American Progress. Previously, he served in the United States House of Representatives representing Central and Southern Virginia. And before entering politics, he worked as a conflict analyst and as an advocate on environmental and poverty issues. In 2010, Time magazine named him as part of their 40 Under 40 series, citing his record as an unapologetic progressive. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with somebody who worked inside the United States Senate to try and bring the Wall Street titans to justice after crashing the economy in 2008.
Definition of a rat race. Pay off those losers we elect to lead. Steal them from the mouths that put them to feed. Enslaving.
Bang, bang, yeah. That's how we start the show. Eagle soar and oil flow. You didn't decide what you chose. We will pay back what they owe. Crime depends from who you sold. We cheer for the villains though. Hustling, bustling, hitting low. Motion is perpetual. We call jill to give and go. All you reap is what you sow. No, where are the controls? Mass of individuals consuming as ritual. You ain't hear them say by slow. Dude, don't let them play us.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeff Connaughton, who is the author of the new book, The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. He previously worked for 4 years as an investment banker, first at Smith Barney and then at E.F. Hutton. Additionally, he served as special assistant to the counsel to the president in the Clinton White House and then as special assistant to then-chairman Joseph Biden of the Senate Judiciary Committee and later as chief of staff for Senator Ted Kaufman. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Connaughton.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And your book is quite a bombshell. You've worked both sides of the street, if you will, both as a lobbyist, as a banker, and as an aide to both Senator Biden and his successor, Senator Ted Kaufman. Particularly, the book deals with that particular period where the senator is trying to reform Wall Street. And it's a kind of blow-by-blow, and it is really an invaluable insight into why it is that we've had, in effect, no justice in the sense that Wall Street took the global economy to the brink of extinction back in 2008. Nobody's gone to jail, and the middle class are still paying for it. So it's a monstrous crime that has still gone unpunished.
Yes, and I mean, I'm not trying to hold myself out as a paragon of virtue. As you said, I mean, I spent 12 years in Washington as a corporate lobbyist myself. I mean, many people who go to Washington do both government service, and then you find yourself sort of drawn into, well, how am I going to make a living? And whether it's at a law firm or a public relations firm or a lobbying firm, you're pretty much working for corporate America or Wall Street most of the time. But when the financial crisis hit, I mean, to me, that was a seismic event. I mean, it nearly brought the country to its knees. I mean, it was obvious that millions of people were suffering. So when Ted Kaufman, who I had known for 20 years, was appointed to take Joe Biden's seat in the Senate and asked me to be his chief of staff, I went in back into government, you know, determined with Ted to really do something about Wall Street power and reform. And what was shocking to me, and I suppose, you know, I of all people should have known since I had gone along with, you know, a good bit of what's wrong with Washington, what was shocking to me was how poorly the system performed both before the financial crisis leading to the disaster and in responding to the financial crisis. And the book is really me trying to provide an inside-the-room account of what Ted tried hard to do for 2 years and failed on all fronts.
And specifically what Senator Ted Kaufman and you as his chief of staff were trying to do was to hold Wall Street executives accountable?
Our initial thought was, you know, while it was a gigantic crisis with thousands of transactions, players and firms and you know, financial instruments involved, somewhere in all of that there might have been law breaking. and therefore the Justice Department needed to be both organized, dedicated, and well-resourced to target any financial fraud that might have occurred during the crisis. And the role of Congress is really limited. I mean, all we can't really ask about the specifics of any case. All we can do is urge the Justice Department to be strategic, to be targeted, to be funded, to dedicate itself. And so Ted first worked on legislation called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act with Senators Leahy and Grassley, a Republican of Iowa, which passed the Congress, authorized an additional $165 million for the Justice Department and FBI to target high-level securities fraud that might have occurred on Wall Street. And when no cases began to arise, Ted decided to ask Chairman Leahy if he could chair oversight hearings of the Justice Department and FBI. And essentially what we found in the course of our dealings with the Justice Department was that it really needed a timely all-in approach. And instead, Central Justice, frankly, just did not organize itself to add to what was already taking place at the local U.S. Attorney's Office. There was no sort of muscular, additional, centralized approach like, you know, the Bush Justice Department did with Enron. And so that failure, you know, the New York Times just editorialized about it yesterday. I mean, here we are 4 years later, the statutes of limitations have passed, and not one single executive on Wall Street was even indicted, you know, or tried to be accused of financial fraud. And I feel like it was a failure of the Justice Department leadership, and, you know, we saw it as it was unfolding 2 years ago in the Senate.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeff Connaughton, the author of the new book, The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. He previously worked for 4 years as an investment banker, first at Smith Barney and then at E.F. Hutton. And additionally, he served as a special assistant to the counsel to the president in the Clinton White House and then a special assistant to then-chairman Joseph Biden of the Senate Judiciary Committee and later as chief of staff for Senator Ted Kaufman. And the book chronicles the long struggle by both Jeff Connaughton and Senator Kaufman to hold Wall Street accountable for securities fraud, to stop stock manipulation by high-frequency traders, and to break up the too-big-to-fail mega banks. And you know, some time back, I recall, Jeff, 60 Minutes did a pretty scathing piece on why it is, the very questions you're asking, why is it that the Justice Department haven't brought anybody to justice for what happened on Wall Street in 2008? And they said that they were working on it. One of the things that the book reveals is that both the reluctance of the White House to do anything, the Justice Department's torpor, but the SEC, who are supposed to be in charge of, they're supposed to be the cops on the beat. Robert Kazumi, the director of SEC's Enforcement Division, when asked about federal judges rebuking the SEC for levying paltry fines, said to your boss, Senator Kaufman, "I'm not losing any sleep over it." What explains that?
Well, I think, you know, it appears that the Justice Department at some point decided that they were not going to be pursuing criminal charges against anyone on Wall Street and that they were going to be leaving it to the Securities and Exchange Commission to pursue only civil actions against banks. And that's because in a criminal action, the Justice Department would have to prove every element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury, whereas in a civil action, it's a much lower standard, only a preponderance of the evidence. But what the SEC did was they didn't target individuals. I mean, there seemed to be this concern at the Justice Department and the SEC that the financial system was still so fragile that if they targeted firms on Wall Street with any type of criminal action, that would only make matters worse. But that was a false choice. I mean, prosecutors can single out individuals, both for criminal actions and for civil actions by the SEC. But instead, the SEC only reached settlements with most of the major banks for, you know, relatively paltry fines, even though they're in the hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases. These banks are absolutely gigantic, you know, which make billions of dollars in profits a year. And so that was only the semblance of accountability of law. I mean, there was no individuals held to account, and federal judges were indeed rebuking the SEC for failing to achieve the deterrence
that the facts demand. And when we asked Mr. Kazami about it, he said he wasn't losing any sleep over it. Now, to his point, I mean, he did win the appeal. I mean, there was a judge who actually threw out a settlement against one of the banks as being inadequate. And on appeal in the Second Circuit, the higher court said, well, the SEC can reach settlements at small amounts, and it's really not the role of judges to sort of second-guess the SEC's determination of when they're going to go to trial versus when they're going to settle for a fine. But the bottom line is that no one went to jail. No individuals faced sanctions. The big banks basically went through a toll booth by paying relatively paltry fines, and we're left with an America that has absolutely no confidence in our justice system and whether or not powerful people on Wall Street, individuals especially, will ever be held to account for any lawbreaking. And that's just an unacceptable situation, and one that frustrated and angered me so much that I decided to leave Washington and write a book about it, frankly.
Well, we're grateful that you have, Jeff Connaughton, because this really is a book that reveals the struggle to bring justice and why the powers in Washington were able to fight back. And it also, I think, indicates the broader struggles that we as a society are undergoing, where the extent to which our economy has become a plutonomy and the extent to which politics have been captured by an oligarchy. And that seems to be implicit here in the sense that these mega banks have so much political clout. They've essentially gone to war against the Dodd-Frank bill, and they still are holding that up. As you mentioned, the New York Times mentioned that they basically, the Justice Department, are given up on going after Goldman Sachs. And is this really, is that the bottom line, the capture of our politicians, particularly on the Republican side, but also on the Democratic side?
Yes. I mean, this is not a new problem. I mean, Woodrow Wilson said in 1913 that when government makes decisions that affect big business, isn't it natural that big business would want to get close to and capture big business? Wilson said, isn't it natural? It's already happened. Regulatory capture has long been a problem, but during the course of my two decades in Washington and my 12 years as a lobbyist, the amount of money that corporate America spends in Washington tripled. And it's really become the case now that whoever in government reaches a level of substantial responsibility in the public sector can cash in a big way in the private sector immediately upon leaving office. I did it myself. I mean, no one's ever heard of me. I mean, I never registered on the power scale in any kind of meaningful way. I mean, I did work briefly in the Clinton White House. I did work for Senator Biden. But I ended up making a lot of money over the course of my career because there's so much money to be made in Washington now. And so that skews outcomes. I mean, there are a lot of honorable people, there are a lot of ethical people in Washington who are working hard every day trying to do the right thing by the American people. But the big picture is the town is floating in corporate money. And the typical career path is too much like mine, people can accuse me of hypocrisy, but my defense is, I mean, for me, the financial crisis was a shock the conscience event. I mean, it really was something unlike we've ever seen in our lifetimes. And it had a devastating impact on people. And to go back into government then and see how one-sided political power has become and making it virtually impossible to get, the kind of response to the financial system that we should have had, it was very disillusioning for me and should be for all Americans. We don't have a two-party political system that works here. I mean, we don't have Republicans criticizing the Obama Justice Department for failing to go hard enough after Wall Street because the Republican Party is raising money in buckets from Wall Street just like the Democrats are. I mean, one of the things that was unique about Ted Kaufman was he was appointed to the seat, and he said immediately that he wasn't going to run in the special election 2 years later. So he didn't have to raise money to become a senator or to stay in the Senate. He had a 2-year term where he decided, I'm just going to do what I think is right. And I was different from most staffers because I was older and I had already gone through the revolving door twice and I had already made quite a bit of money, so I didn't care about where my next job was coming from. And, you know, I think that was one of the reasons why the Kaufman tale is worth reading, as Simon Johnson wrote yesterday and or over the weekend in Huffington Post. I mean, it's sort of an indication of what we might get if we could somehow get the influence of money out of politics.
Well, Jeff Connaughton, your book really shows us how much the public have ponied up and what ingrates Wall Street are. It points out, for example, that Citigroup and Bank of America, which the two of the largest financial mega banks, they would have failed in 2008 but for government bailouts. But you get the impression that not only are the Wall Street titans not grateful, they're kind of indignant that people don't respect them more. I just find it extraordinary. What do they think they're doing? Don't they see the big picture of how the financialization of the economy is a one-way street? It's about extracting wealth, not creating wealth. And it's almost like the country's eating its economic seed corn.
Right. I mean, one of Ted's favorite sayings was, never underestimate the ability of the human mind to rationalize its actions. I mean, these mega banks have become so gigantic and so powerful that they defend their existence as, oh, we need to be this big to compete globally, to provide the kinds of services that U.S. corporate clients need. But that's just not true. I mean, it's demonstrably not true. Alan Greenspan, when he was Federal Reserve Chairman, said there are no economies of scale to banks larger than $100 billion in assets. Today we have mega banks that have assets between $2 trillion and $4 trillion. I mean, the sum total of the assets of the six largest banks in the United States is equal to two-thirds of the United States gross domestic product. So if one of those banks fails, regardless of what was in Dodd-Frank, we're going to be in another situation where we're either going to have to bail them out because by failing they would wreak systemic havoc and take down, you know, the rest of the financial sector and the country with it, you know, or we're going to have to pony up money to keep them afloat. And there's just no justification for not breaking them up. Yet when Ted and Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio offered an amendment to Dodd-Frank to put limits on the size of these banks, on the leverage that they can use, on the liabilities that they roll over every night to finance themselves, it was defeated in the Senate primarily because of the opposition of the Obama Treasury Department. I mean, the technocrats at the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department were saying to Congress, no, don't write any hard lines in statute. We can deal with this at the international level by determining capital requirements for banks with our counterparts in other countries, and we will increase the capital requirements for these banks. And Ted would say, well, there's just one problem. I mean, what happens if, you know, 2 years, 6 years, 10 years from now, a president gets elected who doesn't believe in regulation, you know, who appoints regulators just like the ones who failed us in the run-up to the crisis? I mean, the Greenspan era regulators were free market ideologues who didn't believe that regulation was necessary. I mean, without putting hard lines into the statute, without breaking up these banks by statutory lines, you know, you don't get the kind of change we need. I mean, just today in the Financial Times, Nicholas Brady, who was the Republican Treasury Secretary under George Bush the First, wrote that this regulation that Dodd-Frank has produced is so complicated, what we really need are simple lines, like leverage requirements. Well, that was what the Brown-Kaufman Amendment was. You know, so we still have this debate raging in this country about too big to fail. Dodd-Frank didn't end the debate. The big banks are still out there. There's still a sort of Damocles hanging over the U.S. economy. And until enough Americans sort of wake up, get involved, enough non-financial business people wake up and understand that financial stability is what we need in this country for the economy to thrive, then we're not going to get the kind of change that we need to rein in Wall Street excess.
Well, just in closing, Jeff Connaughton, given that our government has largely been captured by Wall Street and by Wall Street's money, and that after this extraordinary act of reckless incompetence, where they basically took the global economy to the brink and then were subsequently rewarded by the taxpayer and have ever since gotten even bigger and more arrogant. And so I guess my question would be, you know, if we're living in the era of, you know, instead of the era of Thomas Edison and Henry Ford, we're now in the era of Jamie Dimon and John Paulson. What other power centers are there in the country that if our government has failed us, could corporate America step up? Because I noticed over the weekend, David Gregory was hosting a group of CEOs, Bob Wright, Lou Gerstner, former head of IBM, and Jack Welch, former head of General Electric. They were all very critical of Wall Street. IBM CEO Gerstner saying that a lot of people in the business community are totally fed up with what's going on in the financial services industry. And he went on to say, you know, that these golden parachutes, so many of these idiot CEOs, as I'm quoting him, get when they get fired is completely unconscionable. So it sounds like there's a little bit of awakening, at least in corporate America. So, you know, short of educating the public, as you just suggested, and the public, of course, are being bamboozled by political ads at the moment, so I wouldn't count on that. What would be the countervailing power centers that could be a check and balance against the growing power of Wall Street?
You're absolutely right. I mean, it's going to take non-financial corporate America waking up and realizing that it has a stake here. It takes power to beat power. In Washington, I mean, there was one amendment where the retailers across America, Walmart, Home Depot, opposed the credit card banks for the swipe fees that they charge at the retail counter, and that amendment passed. It passed by, it surprised everyone, but you had a coalition of big business opposing Wall Street credit card banks, and the big business powers won. I mean, I think it takes a combination of citizens. I mean, if the Occupy movement, if the Tea Party movement realized that they shared common ground in fighting crony capitalism, there's absolutely no reason why the Tea Party should be in favor of Wall Street power. I mean, they wanted to bring change to Washington, but they didn't bring it in a way that I was hoping, you know, it would happen. I mean, you know, it's going to take, you know, a decade, and I see it like a game of Rover, Red Rover. I do think there are people crossing over, you know, some of the executives you just mentioned, Sandy Weil, who put together Citigroup, you know, shocked Wall Street just 2 weeks ago by calling for the reinstatement of the Glass-Steagall Act, which, you know, it was only the repeal of Glass-Steagall that allowed him to put together Citigroup in the first place. So I do think people are going to change their views and positions, and at some point, it might take a decade, it might take a Teddy Roosevelt or an FDR or somebody to lead the reform movement, but at some point, a critical mass will be reached and will get change. At least that's what we all have to hope for and try for.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Jeff Connaughton.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeff Connaughton, who's the author of The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. He previously worked for 4 years as an investment banker, first at Smith Barney and then at E.F. Hutton. Additionally, he served as a special assistant to the counsel to the president in the Clinton White House and then as special assistant to then-chairman Joseph Biden of the Senate Judiciary Committee and later as chief of staff for Senator Ted Kaufman. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Michelle Manos and Brooke Peterson. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time